The Oracle Network.
Welcome to Brew Crime. I'm Mike, and my guests today are...
I'm Emily from the podcast Morbidology. Each week on Morbidology, I uncover a new true crime case using investigative research combined with source audio. Morbidology is a victim-focused podcast that mostly covers cases that aren't widely documented in mainstream media. I also like to take an in-depth look at any systemic failures which had a part to play in the crime.
Perfect. And the other guest today...
Hi, I'm Emma from the True Crime Witch podcast.
Perfect. All right. Today's theme is unsolved group murders, which was a theme recommended by Emily here. So cover two cases of unsolved group murders. So the beer pairing today, because why haven't these cases been solved yet? Are we there yet? I was having so much trouble trying to find a beer pairing for this theme. So I went with that. This is from Mariner Brewing in Coquitlam. And it is a Belgian dark strong ale. Oh, 8.1% alcohol. So up my alley, not up your guys' alley.
No. And no, 5%. No, thank you.
That's far too much, Mike.
I'd drink half and I'd just be like, okay, I have to go to bed now.
Mm-hmm. That's always an option. It's got like a nice like coppery color, sort of off-white head. Kind of a dark fruit aroma. Bit of sugar sweetness. That's about it for the nose. Yeah, it's definitely dark fruits, sort of a little bit of stone fruit flavor in there. Belgian candy sugar, brown sugar. It's not overly sweet, but it's definitely on the sweet side and doesn't show the alcohol at all. It's easy drinking. It could be really dangerous.
Oh, one of them ones where you've had one and then you're like, it's okay. It doesn't taste that strong. And then all of a sudden you're hammered.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Title for my story, it's really the billion-dollar question. Who did it? Bernard Arbery and Honey Sherman were wealthy and powerful, sitting at an estimated wealth of $3.2 billion U.S. dollars, or possibly $4.77 billion Canadian. Kind of hard to tell because with the change of exchange rates, who knows?
Either way, it's a lot of money.
Yeah. This would make them reportedly either the 12th or 15th wealthiest Canadians in 2017. So, very wealthy. Also, it's amazing there's between 12 and 15, or 11 and 14 people more rich than that in Canada. But unfortunately, being a billionaire does not make you invincible. So let's go back a bit and learn a bit about the couple. Bernard was born on February 25th, 1942 in Toronto, Ontario, to parents Herbert Dick Hyman Sherman. And the mother was Sarah Sherman, both of Jewish descent. His grandparents on both sides had to flee both Russia and Poland due to persecution for being a Jew. Herbert was a partner in a zipper manufacturer in the Toronto area. His father died when he was young, at the age of 10. Bernard was a very smart kid, extremely smart. He would be the winner of a national physics contest while in high school and would excel. He would be able to enroll in the University of Toronto Engineering Science Program in 1958, just to catch up. That means he was 16 years old, and he was the youngest kid to ever do that until Madeline Zhang, I think is her name, who joined at age 14 in 2016. So we're talking really, really friggin' smart.
Really smart.
Damn.
I wish.
Don't we all?
Yeah. His reasoning for picking the university and the program was that it was supposed to be the hardest program that they offered. It wasn't even because he wanted to do that. It was just that was the hardest thing they had.
Big ambitions.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. As a summer job during his schooling, he would work as a driver for his uncle, Louis Lloyd Winters, who owned Empire Laboratories, who happened to be the largest Canadian-owned pharmaceutical company at the time. He would graduate University of Toronto with the highest honors in his class and would end up getting a Governor General's Award for his thesis. This guy was smart.
Yeah, this guy was very smart. Yeah.
That's quite an understatement, Mike.
Yeah. After his time at the U of T, he would enroll in a well-known school in MIT or Massachusetts Institute of Technology, which is known as probably the best university or tech school in the world, I think. Mm-hmm. He would study doctoral studies in engineering. In 1967, he would get his PhD in astrophysics from MIT. So if you're doing the math, that was a degree at the University of Toronto and a PhD at MIT by his 25th birthday.
That's insane.
Yeah, I wish. I couldn't do that now when I'm well past that date.
I couldn't even begin to even contemplate doing that. No.
Yeah, my 25th birthday is in 2 months, and
you've got a few months, Emma. Going on that then.
I've got the undergraduate. I just need to get the PhD done in 2 months. So yeah. I'll see you in a bit.
Snap, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So let's move over to Honey Sherman. Honey was born in Austria in 1948 to Polish Jewish parents. Her parents were Holocaust survivors that immigrated to Canada. Much like Bernard, she would come from humble roots. I was sadly not able to find a lot of information on her young life. I really tried. Unfortunately, she was just the wife of this like really successful businessman. I tried. In 1965, Bernard's uncle, who owned Empire Group of Companies, Lewis Lloyd Winter, would pass away, followed quickly by his wife, Beverly, only 17 days later. Their children, Paul, Timothy, Jeffrey Andrew, Carrie Joel Dexter, and Dana Charles, didn't seem to be up to running the company, as it seems they were too young. But Bernard would purchase the company in 1967. So he's already moving up in the world. I have no idea where the money came from, as it didn't sound like his family had a lot of money at the time.
Mm-hmm.
But his father did die when he was 10, and his mom struggled. So maybe there was something from his father's company, but they struggled all the way up until he bought this company. So I don't really know. Part of the deal, though, was that he would employ all of his uncle and aunt's kids at Empire when they turned 21, and they would get 5% ownership in the company. There was a clause, though, that if he sold the company, it would be voided. It wouldn't take him long to void that contract either, as he would sell a controlling stake of the company to his leading customer in a share swap. So this is a massive influx of cash, and it would lead to Bernard investing in New York's Bar Laboratories. He would become the largest shareholder at 1/3 of all stock and would serve as the president of the company. So you can watch him just like moving up the chain really fast here. And, you know, possibly screwing family members out of money, a lot of money. 1971 would see Honey and Bernard get married. During their marriage, they would have 4 children, Jonathan, Lauren, Alexandra, and Colleen. I think that's how you pronounce her name. In 1972, he would sell the rest of Empire Laboratories to International Chemical and Nuclear Quebec branch of the California Company. So it's a huge, huge company. In 1973, a few former Empire employees would start up Apotex, I think is the pronunciation. It's APOTEX, Inc.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be incorporated the next year. Apotex would grow to be the largest Canadian-owned pharmaceutical company. They were known for making generic versions of medications that were sold all over the world. Sherman would also help found the National Institute for Nutrition in Canada and get involved in the nutraceutical industry. To skip ahead a bit, his company would employ 10,000 Canadians with a portfolio of 260 drugs that were sold to more than 115 countries. We're talking big, big time.
Mm-hmm.
At the time, the company made a revenue of $1.5 billion. So like many billionaires, he would be involved with many other projects, including many that were not the drug industry. Many of these would turn out to be scams, but he didn't realize it at the time.
Mm-hmm.
This is when Honey gets back into the picture, as she was big into philanthropy. She would be the driving force into donating to the United Jewish Appeal, a group that helped Jewish people, even though Bernard was an atheist, to the tune of $50 million. They would also donate to other Jewish charities, and fund a large addition to the Baycrest Center for geriatric people, elderly. Mm-hmm. They also donated a ton to the United Way and would send $50 million worth of medicine to disaster zones. Bernard would even personally loan his employees money when they needed help. Unfortunately, like so many rich people, it was not all for the good of people, as many of the foundations they would donate to were set up by him and his company, and once the money was donated, he would get loans in the exact same amount back while still getting a massive tax break.
Yeah.
I thought that was where that was going.
You know, there's a lot of shady stuff happening as well here, and not talking bad about the dead, but I'm just trying to point out the fact that there could be a lot of people that don't like this family, right? Even though they're doing a lot of...
He sounds like he was doing the world of good, but...
But at the same time, he was also hurting a lot of people without people knowing it. And that kind of builds up to what's happening here. Mm-hmm. Their mansion that they had custom built that was finished in 1996 in North York took 5 years to complete. Once done, they were so unhappy with the construction, they filed 12 lawsuits against the builders and contractors. They would end up winning $2.3 million, and it would almost cover the entire cost of the build in 2017.
Ugh. So they're obviously very, very seedy people.
Mm-hmm. Very money-driven.
Very money-driven.
Yeah.
This is all building to the fact that the couple were making enemies on the business side. This would become even more prevalent when Apotex began their long run of legal battles with other pharmaceutical companies. At the time of Bernard's death, the company had 1,200 active court cases against the federal government alone. They would cost Canadian taxpayers millions of dollars. Bernard was once quoted as telling his employees that Apotex was actually a legal company that sold medicine on the side. He also was quoted as saying, "The branded drug companies hate us. They have private investigators on us all the time. The thought once came to my mind, why didn't they just hire someone to knock me off?" So, yeah.
That's what happened.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
Oh, my God. I've never heard of this case before.
I know. That's a lot of lawsuits against a pharmaceutical company. Like, how did that not warrant, like, an investigation by an authorizing body to be like, hey, what's going on? Because clearly that's a lot of lawsuits. Yeah.
Those 1,200 are just against the government. That's not all the other ones.
What are they suing the
Exactly, yeah.
Why is that not flagged somewhere?
I know, yeah.
I'm sure there was a lot of flags.
Yeah.
It is also said that once Bayer, the German pharma company, thought of hiring someone to plant illegal drugs in his car in the hopes that Apotex employees would spill dirt on the owner, as they were sure that Apotex was infringing on Bayer patents. So yeah, like, we're talking... Big, big time issues.
Yeah.
2011 would see his cousins, the Winters, drop a massive lawsuit against Bernard to the tune of 20% interest in Apotex, or $1 billion they felt they were owed from the sale of their father's company in 1970.
What?
Yeah. In return, Bernard would tighten the purse strings as he had been sending the family millions of dollars in financial support. So, you know... Okay, you're going to sue me? No more money, right?
Mm-hmm.
2017 would see the lawsuit go in Bernard's favor, and the judge would be quoted as saying the case was wishful thinking and beyond fanciful. He would award Bernard $300,000 in legal fees to be paid by the Winters. So not only did Winters get screwed, they got screwed again. So right around the same time, Apotex would lose a court battle to the tune of $500 million. And due to that, there were layoffs happening. Bernard and his company would also be involved with illegal fundraising for the Liberal Party of Canada, but would not end up being charged with anything. It's like he's got his fingers in a lot of stuff. 2017 would see the Sherman family decide it was time to make a move and build a brand new 16,000 square foot or 1,500 square meter mansion in Forest Hill near Toronto. As I mentioned earlier, they won $2.3 million in a lawsuit against the builders of their old home in 2017. Mm-hmm. So they were going to use that money as well as another $7 million from the sale of their old home to build the new one. December 12, 2017, Honey would join her husband as well as the architect, custom home builder, and subcontractors at the Apotex office to go over some of the changes to the design of their new $20 million home. The meeting would wrap up around 5:30 p.m. and Honey would head home as Bernard had some more work to finish up at the office. Being the workaholic, he would go home and then send off an email to staff about a drug they were producing. So usually at some point in the night, he would phone people from Apotex as he was an insomniac, so it wouldn't stop. It would be all night. This night, that didn't happen. This was also the last day the couple were seen alive. So moved to December 15th, 2017. Neither Bernard or Honey were to be home as they were going to have a showing at their home because they were selling it. Cleaning staff had been to the home in the morning and didn't notice anything out of the ordinary. A pair of realtors arrived mid-morning with a couple from China who were interested in the home. So they showed them around the house, and once they were finished, they moved on to the garage. And the garage was a little special. It had a tennis court on the roof and a lap pool below. So they headed down the stairs to the pool, but what they would see was awful. Bernard and Honey were pushed up against a metal railing, facing away from the water with their necks tied to the railing with leather belts.
Ooh.
Yeah.
That's grim.
Yeah. Bernard was sitting upright while Honey was leaning over with some bruising on her face. Their hands were bound in some way with their jacket, but they were both fully clothed. So it sounds like kind of their jackets were fitted in a way maybe so they couldn't move their hands. I don't really know.
Yeah. Maybe used to bind them somehow.
Somehow, yeah. I'm not quite sure. They were fully bound somehow. But yeah, they were very much dead, unfortunately. It was said that Honey almost never headed down to the pool anymore as her 70-year-old knees just didn't do well with the stairs. Mm-hmm. That being said, her phone was found in a bathroom by the pool. She was said to never use that bathroom. So it sounds like a weird detail to me. Like, why were they down there? Why was she in that washroom?
Yeah.
Like, were they fleeing from someone? I don't know.
Were they trying to get away? Were they taken down there? Something
mm-hmm.
a bit strange.
So originally, the police somehow thought this was a murder-suicide. But how the hell are you both bound and strangled if it's a murder-suicide? Like, it doesn't make sense to me.
What is the logic behind that? How can you both be bound?
Yeah.
So what, you kill your wife and then kill yourself and somehow bind yourself?
I've heard of cases where someone does, like, bind themselves to fake it, but not like this.
No.
Yes.
Very complex.
Yeah.
Very complex crime scene, it sounds like.
The family were so upset with the police work that they hired their own investigators. In January 2018, the family's team would anonymously release info to the Toronto Star, pointed to the fact that this was actually a double murder. So it wasn't even the police that let people know this was a murder. It was the family's investigators, which is bizarre. Only after this, the police would come out and say that they believed that this was a targeted murder. By September 2018, more than 20 search warrants would be issued, but nothing was really coming from the investigation. Move on to October 2018. The family offered a $10 million reward for information that would lead to arrest and prosecution. The family were getting more and more impatient with even more than 50 officers on the case, 200 witnesses being interviewed, and with more than 2,000 hours of surveillance being done, and nothing. The original estimated time of death from the Toronto police was sometime on December 15th. And it was only later that they would amend this to say that they were likely killed on the 13th. So, I mean, there's some issues with the police work here, unfortunately.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, the Toronto police, it's a big, big city. You think they'd kind of be a bit more well-equipped to deal with crimes of this gratitude.
But biggest city in Canada.
Yeah, like, it's like the kind of thing you would expect in, like, a little small town where the police force aren't really...
Yeah.
Be able to deal with something of that magnitude, if you know what I mean.
Or there's one or two police officers total.
Yeah. When you think of a big city, you think of a lot of experienced detectives, not people that would.
Yeah. And I mean, the worst part too is that as much as I hate this happens, like, they're billionaires. You kind of expect this is where the police are probably going to spend a lot of their time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you'd think they would maybe give it a bit more. Yeah.
These are the rich and the powerful.
Horrible, yeah. As horrible it is to say that, you would think because they're wealthy that police would maybe be a bit more interested in solving it.
Unfortunately, we just see that all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So the kids would become split on the private investigation team and disbanded, with one of the sons immediately hiring a new private investigator to work on the case. So some of them wanted to just sit back and let the police do their thing and not get in the way, and the one was just like, fuck that. So April 25th, 2019, the Toronto police would state that they had a working theory of what had happened the day of the murders, but to this day, they still are no closer to publicly catching the murderers or a murderer. We are now in 2021, and there are still no public suspects or persons of interest in this case. Not one. The real problem with this case, though, is that it could be a random attack, but that definitely seems a bit unlikely. The family had made so many enemies, making them billionaires. Lawsuits against family, pharmaceutical companies, government bodies, not that I think that they are suspects, as well as many other people. This is a really messy case, and I hope one day they figure it out, because holy crap.
Mm-hmm. I've never heard of that before. I've never heard of that case whatsoever.
I hadn't either, and I mean, I live in Canada. But yeah, no, that's the story of Bernard and Honey Sherman. It's just, it's bizarre. Like, the fact that these two were murdered, there seems to be, there's got to be some evidence somewhere. Like, how is this not being figured out?
Yeah, you'd think there would be some kind of fingerprints or something. Yeah. Like, they, if they were bond especially, like, it seems like there would be something somewhere.
Yeah. But I mean, there's so many places you could look at for people that could have done it, because he screwed family. He screwed, you know, other huge multinational pharmaceutical companies. He's, you know, not that the government's going to be involved, but there's so many lawsuits. Like, there's so many people that could be involved with this. The builders of his old house, like, you know, it's just, who knows?
Do you think maybe in a way, because the police just initially ruled it as a suicide, that the crime scene was potentially mishandled and contaminated? Because it seems kind of bizarre that, like, a crime of that magnitude, that there was no evidence left behind. But if they ruled it a suicide, maybe they didn't think to...
I was about to say the exact same thing, Emily.
Conduct, like, a proper crime scene investigation.
Or because if they didn't even figure out the PMI, which is the postmortem index, properly, who knows if evidence had been mishandled, evidence contaminated, et cetera, et cetera. And if they're trying to cover up for the fact that they mishandled evidence and were unable to obtain fingerprints, or for whatever reason that evidence is no longer viable, then yeah, it seems like something isn't quite right there.
Yeah, it seems fishy for sure.
Mm-hmm.
I think definitely part of it is probably the fact that the police didn't take it seriously as a murder.
Mm-hmm.
Because unfortunately, regardless if you think it's a suicide, you should do everything the same way.
Yeah.
But you know how often that doesn't happen.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It just seems crazy that, like, you could go down and see these two people bond at their swimming pool and just think, okay, well, they committed suicide. Let's just leave it at that. Let's not conduct a thorough investigation of the crime scene.
As awful as it is, most people that complete suicide usually leave a note. Not always, but there's often a note and stuff. There's none of that.
It just goes against the ABCs of crime scene investigation. Assume nothing, believe nothing, check everything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That is just, you, until you have a conclusive answer, you can't just jump to assumptions, because things are often very different than what they first appear.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, that's my case.
Can't believe I've never heard of that before. Interesting case.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely an interesting case. Okay, so I'm going to be talking about the unsolved Keddy murders. Keddy is a tiny settlement in Plumas County on the outskirts of Quincy in California. At one point in time, Keddy was a bustling resort town. At the center of the hub was Keddy Resort, a collection of 33 rustic cabins, which could be rented out long-term. The stream was perfect for fishing, and the pine-studded trails were a favorite amongst the hikers. However, 40 years ago, I think it was 40 years ago last month.
Oh, geez.
Yeah, so it's the anniversary this year. This Queen settlement was rocked by a brutal quadruple murder that still remains unsolved. I'm sure both of you probably know about this case already.
A little bit, yeah. But what you mentioned there, it just sounds idyllic, right? It sounds like a great place to go on holidays.
Yeah.
So it's I hate like when if that you kind look at happens.
Yeah, if you look at the photos of it, it looks pretty cool, but not too much anymore.
Hmm.
So it was a bright spring morning on the 12th of April, 1981, when 14-year-old Sheila Sharp entered cabin 28 on Keddy Resort Road after attending a nearby sleepover. The Sharp family had been living in cabin 28 for the past 5 months. Upon opening the front door, Sheila was met by a very gruesome scene. At some point during the previous night, somebody had entered cabin 28 and ruthlessly murdered Sheila's mother, Glenna Sue Sharp, her 15-year-old brother, John Sharp, and her brother's 17-year-old friend, Dana Wingate.
Jeez.
Sheila ran screaming back to the neighbouring cabin, where she had spent the night beforehand, cabin 27. A member of the Seabolt family ran to the lodge at Keddy Resort, and co-owner Jan Albin placed a call to police, alerting them to the murder scene in cabin 28. As police were on their way to the crime scene, Sheila remembered that her two younger brothers, 10-year-old Greg Sharp and 5-year-old Rick Sharp, were still inside the cabin, along with their friend, 12-year-old Justin. Miraculously, all three boys were unharmed.
That's Seabolt. So awesome, right?
Yeah, I can't imagine what it's like. Like, obviously, coming across a crime scene and it's your family, and then obviously, in like the moment, you don't even register that. Oh shit, there might be other people that I'd completely mm-hmm. forgotten about, and then to find them that they're okay. I can't imagine the feeling.
Yeah,
the Seabolt family helped the boys climb out of the window at cabin 28. Apparently, all three boys had slept through the entire massacre. Deputy Hank Clement was the first officer on the scene. All three of the victims had been bound with electrical wire and medical tape before they were systematically bludgeoned to death with a claw hammer. The murders of Sue, John, and Dana had been particularly vicious. In addition to being bludgeoned, Sue and John had been stabbed a bunch of times with a sharp object, and their throats had been slashed.
That is just awful. I mean, that's just... so much violence. It's just
awful. That's a lot of anger and a lot of rage.
Yeah, especially if you look at the house, like when you kind of talk about it, it seems like it's going to be like a massive house with all this bloodshed in it, but it's like a tiny little cabin, so yeah. It's a very mm-hmm. confined space, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, it's just a little resort cabin.
Yeah, pretty much. It's just tiny. In addition, Sue had been bludgeoned with a rifle and she had defensive wounds on her arms. She had also been found nude from the waist down with her underwear stuffed in her mouth. Dana's autopsy, and Dana was obviously the friend of the son. His autopsy concluded that in addition to the wounds caused by the claw hammer, he had sustained injuries from a blunt object and had also been manually strangled. Discarded nearby the bodies, investigators would find a knife which had been used during the attack. It had actually been used with such force that it had bent.
Wow.
So obviously whoever did this, it was a very brutal attack. The blood at the crime scene wasn't confined to just the floor or the victims. Blood would additionally be found on the wallpaper in one of the bedrooms, on the living room ceiling, and spattered across the furniture. The bottoms of Sue's bare feet and the soles of one of the boy's shoes were also covered in blood, which obviously indicated that at some point during the attack, they were clearly walking around and stood in their own blood.
Jeez.
Mm. There had also been blood discovered on both of the bedroom doors and outside the handrails on the back steps. It was soon discovered that Sheila's younger sister, if you've forgotten, Sheila was the girl that came to the house in the morning that had stayed overnight at the cabin next door. It was discovered that her sister, 12-year-old Tina Sharp, was missing from the home. Members of the Plumas County Search and Rescue Team scoured the Keddy area for the missing child, but to no avail. An All Points Bulletin was put out to Lassen, Butte, and Sierra Counties in Reno, asking if Tina had been spotted. She was described as having long blonde hair, and she was a slight build. She was wearing blue jeans and also a blue shirt when she was last seen. The bulletin also asked the same areas to check with local hospitals to see if anybody had come in during the last 48 hours with knife injuries. Because obviously they were working on the assumption that whoever had committed the murder, they very well could have been harmed during the attack.
Oh, of course. Yeah. Especially with stabbing and everything. There's often people that when you start stabbing people, you cut yourself, right? So,
Yeah.
The blood makes the handle slick. So what has happened is the handle will slip down, and oftentimes you'll find people who have, you know, stabbed someone, they'll have cuts on their hands, like sort of diagonal across their palms here from where the knife's edges caught them. And plus, if the knife is bent, you're going to have nicks and cuts.
Yeah.
I've seen some pretty nasty pictures of that, but anyway.
Yeah, like, especially when, as you were saying, the knife's bent, clearly it was extremely frenzied. That it seems very plausible that whoever did it probably got harmed in the process. The gruesome murders would send shockwaves throughout the Quain community. Investigators tried to piece together the last known movements of the victims. Witnesses would say that they saw John and Dana, which were the two teenage boys, trying to thumb a ride on the corner of Crescent Street and Roland Street in Quincy near the Gold Pan Motel. This was at some point between 9 p.m. and 10 p.m. on the night of the murders. Their whereabouts after is completely unknown, even to this day. At some point over the next 10 hours, the teenage boys ended up back at Keddie Resort, where they would be murdered. Early on in the investigation, robbery was ruled out as a motivation, and it was determined that the murders were not drug-related. Investigators had speculated that the murders were somewhat prepared, and had been perpetrated by two or more assailants, one of which had brought along a claw hammer and then used an additional hammer and knives found from inside the home.
Wow.
Investigators also theorized that the killers had worn gloves. What perplexed the investigators the most was that it was a violent and frenzied attack, yet nobody had heard a thing. Not Greg, Rick, or Justin, or the neighbors who had lived a mere 10 feet away. As mentioned, this was obviously mostly used as like a holiday resort. So it was like cabins that were pretty close to each other, but they were renting them for long term. But other people that were there, it was people that were on holiday and people that were renting for like a month or two. But like they were super close to each other, but nobody seemed to hear a thing. And obviously it was an extremely brutal attack.
Yeah, that's bizarre. Yeah.
But yeah, nobody heard anything. The first few weeks of the investigation, the Plumas County Sheriff's Department had 8 investigators working on the case around the clock. They implemented a secret witness program to try and gain leads. They subsequently released sketches of 2 men who were seen in Quincy the week before the murders. Plumas County Sheriff Doug Thomas said, "They're still not necessarily suspects, but they were around the area and vanished shortly before the crimes. They were seen by more than one witness." These 2 men were never identified, and eventually the tips would dwindle to a trickle before diminishing almost completely. Plumas County Sheriff Sergeant Steve Wright said, "By the time a year had elapsed, we would react and investigate leads as they came in." There was much speculation over the years that the killer or killers had wanted to get Tina, who was by this point obviously still missing. Then in April of 1984, a bottle hunter stumbled across human remains near Feather Falls, northwest of Oroville, around 50 miles from Keddie. These remains would be sent to a laboratory for analysis and identification. Using dental records, the remains would be identified as Tina Sharp. According to the medical examiner, Tina had died sometime after the 1st of November, 1981, which was 6 months after the Keddie murders. Since then, theories as to who committed the quadruple murder and why have abounded. So obviously, Tina was missing for 6 months and then she turned up dead pretty much. So for me personally, that what makes the case even that more bizarre, if you know what I mean.
For sure, yeah.
Yeah.
Like, where was Tina? That did she walk in on something? Did she, do you know what I mean? Because she wasn't there when it's, I don't know.
Yeah. Was she taken with the people? And yeah, who knows?
I think that's the main theory, is that she was
taken
with whoever, which makes it seem plausible that she probably was the most likely targeted person.
Yeah.
Obviously, since then, theories have abounded. One theory was put forward by investigators early on, and that was that the person who had picked up John and Dana in Quincy was the person responsible for the murders. A potential scenario was that after dropping John and Dana off at the cabin, the killer then forced their way into the home and had potentially even been invited in by the teenagers. Another theory was that the driver had nothing to do with the murders. Under that scenario, investigators speculated that John and Dana walked in on the murders taking place and became victims themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Which is arguably one of the most terrifying things to think of, walking in, finding your mother, and do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Earlier in the evening before, John and Dana had hitchhiked back to the cabin. They'd attended a party at the home of a well-known Quincy family. Investigators had also considered the killer or killers had been at the same party. In fact, there had been reports that there was a pair of men at the party that were said to be acting extremely peculiar. In 1996, Robert Joseph Silveria Jr. was looked at as a potential suspect. He lived in Plumas County in the mid-1980s and was known as a courteous man who decorated envelopes with intricate drawings during his time as a county employee. He was arrested in 1996 and suspected of at least 17 murders, including the quadruple Ketty murders. So for 15 years, Silveria had drifted throughout the United States on railroads. Following his arrest, he confessed to 28 murders, although he would only be convicted of two of those murders.
Wow. What year did you say again he was drifting?
He lived in Plumas County in the mid-1980s, and it was kind of around 15 years after the mid-1980s, so...
Wow.
They really, kind of...
That's a long time. That's a long time past when I expect a drifter to be on the railway.
Yeah, if you look him up, they kind of tried to connect him to a lot of murders, but it kind of seemed like...
Yeah.
It was one of them cases.
Like, when I hear of drifters on the railway, I think the Great Depression.
15 years is a long time.
Yeah, but it's not the era that I'd ever expect someone to be on the train drifting scene.
But you hear about a lot of cases like that.
Yeah.
You know, it happened in 1996 and he confessed to 28, but they could only convict him of two.
Yeah.
Jeez.
But then you hear of Samuel Little, if you know what I mean, and that was more recent. Because we have more advanced technology, we're more advanced when it comes to forensic science, it's easier to connect people that confess to murders to those actual murders.
Mm-hmm.
So you kind of think with cases like this, if it happened nowadays, would he be convicted of more? Because back in 1996, it wasn't as easy to connect people to murders and convict people of murders. It's an interesting character if you ever look them up. So, in addition to him, among the first suspects to emerge were Martin Ray Smart and John Boubide. And these two have remained the most plausible suspects over the years. In fact, Justin had been the stepson of Smart, and the family lived in the cabin next to Sue. At the time of the murders, Ketty had a large drug house, and one of the key players was allegedly Smart. On the night of the murder, Smart and Boubide showed up at a local Ketty bar, wearing three-piece suits and sunglasses, almost as if they were trying to draw attention to themselves. You can probably guess where this is going.
Mm-hmm.
So, other patrons of the bar recollected that they were acting weird. Both men had criminal records, and Boubide had ties to organized crime in Chicago. Sue was said to be counseling Smart's wife, Marilyn, about leaving her husband because he was allegedly abusive and was seeing other women behind her back. At the time, however, there were also rumors that Sue and Smart had been having an affair. So, there had been speculation among investigators that Smart had learned that Sue and Marilyn had been speaking. Smart was an extremely jealous and possessive man, and according to some investigators, so was Marilyn. Some of the investigators had speculated that it wasn't just Smart and Boubide who were involved in the slaying, but instead a number of other local people. Based on this, many investigators have reached the conclusion the intended victim that night was Sue, and that the others were murdered since there were witnesses. Shortly after the murders, Smart informed police that he used to own a hammer, but claimed that somebody had stolen it. So obviously they think that a hammer was used in the murder, and then this main suspect is saying he had a hammer, but it was stolen.
Doesn't look great.
That's very convenient for him to say it was stolen.
I mean, who steals a hammer?
Actually, no, I mean, you're gonna you'd be surprised at how often hammers are stolen in the construction industry because so many of them are so freaking expensive.
Really?
Oh, yeah, yeah, I know. They can be hundreds and hundreds of dollars for these hammers. Yeah, there's all kinds of specialized, like, stiletto hammers and everything, and you see it all the time. So, now, I doubt this is the case, but, you know, the average hammer that someone has in their home is cheap, but there's certain construction hammers that are hundreds and hundreds of dollars. So, this person probably had a shitty hammer, but, you know, there is a very slight possibility it could be real, because it happens all the time here.
Oh, my God.
I did not know that.
Yeah.
I thought hammers were like a tenner maximum.
Mm-hmm. No.
Shortly thereafter, Smart and Booby left Plumas County for Klamath Falls, Oregon. And it was here that Smart wrote a letter to Marilyn in which he professed his love for her and concludes the letter with, "I've paid the price for your love, and now I've brought it with four people's lives." Which, I mean, come on. That is beyond suspicious.
Yeah, a little bit.
So neither men were ever arrested, and both have since died. Those two are the most plausible suspects. I mean, come on, listening to it. But they obviously both died, so there wasn't really anything. So despite an exhaustive investigation, the Keddie murders still remain unsolved today. Rod DeCrona, a patrol commander for the sheriff's department, said, "It's unusual for someone to get away with killing four people. It bothers me. It's still very creepy to me. I still feel uneasy when I drive through there, when I go on patrol." The Keddie murders are regarded as Plumas County's greatest mystery. The massacre completely destroyed the northern Southern Sierra Mountain Resort. With the killer never being identified, paranoid tourists began staying away from Keddie in droves. Today, Keddie Resort lays abandoned along with the general store and the lodge resort. Nevertheless, Plumas County Sheriff Greg Hagwood still holds on to hope that one day justice will be served. In 2018, he stated, "If it's a deathbed confession, I'll take it."
Man, the fact that one horrible, horrible series of murders, but one series of murders could destroy a very popular place is, it's hard to believe. I mean, unfortunately, like, you know, horrible crimes happen everywhere, and it doesn't usually destroy the ability to bring in tourists in the end. So it's really awful on every, you know, not only did it hurt the victims' families, but it made victims out of the people that owned this resort, right?
Yeah. I think if the resort had still been open now, it would be like a dark tourist.
Oh, yeah.
I think it is.
Is it? I don't know if it's like...
Yeah, I think it's... I've Googled it before. I don't think there's much left, but I think what is left there, I think people have gone to look, if you know what I mean. If you can Google it.
Yeah.
There's a few bits left, but it's...
I think if it was...
The cabin's... Cabin 28's gone, and anywhere where it happened is gone. It's kind of like, if you know the Oklahoma Girl Scouts murder...
Yes.
That's all abandoned, but there's literally nothing left. I think it's kind of the same sort of thing.
I think if it was still like an active resort, kind of like the Cecil Hotel, it would be a major draw for like dark tourist true crime fans. Like, people would pay probably very good money to stay in Cabin 28 had it still been there. Yeah.
People would go just to, as you said, to stay in Cabin 28 and be like, stay in Cabin 28. I think it's one of those cases where we know who did it, but it's too late for justice to be served.
That happens way, way too often, especially if things are bungled originally.
Yeah. I think people like to cling on, especially to that case, because it's quite a well-known case. They like to cling on to the mystery, do you know what I mean? It's such a eerie case, you know, like the family, they're staying in a cabin, someone breaks in the middle of the night. And apparently that was part of the, you know, like the motivation behind the movie The Strangers. Clearly nothing really like that, but
yeah.
You know, I think people like the mystery, but when you look at the evidence, it seems kind of plausible who did it.
I mean, hopefully one of these family members just does one of those DNA family tree tests and
yeah,
upload it to, if you're in the US or North America, I'm not sure about the laws, but if you're up there, then upload your profiles to GEDmatch, please. please
do it. Yeah, I think it's most likely mm-hmm. that it was them too. But people love mystery, so there's that. Mm-hmm.
Well, it's definitely closer to solve than my case. Because there's actually some people that could be guilty, where mine, mm-hmm. no one even has anyone yet.
Oh, God, yeah, definitely.
But yeah, that's the unsolved group murders.
Mm-hmm.
So hopefully everyone's enjoyed this episode. If you've enjoyed the episode, could you go to Apple iTunes or Apple Podcasts and leave a review? And if you'd like to support the podcast, go to patreon.com/brewcrime. Shout out to our Patreon supporters, True Crime Nana, Three Brews In Podcast, Amber, and the Faves of Our Lives. Cheers.
All cases found on Brewcrime are written by Mike or the guest that appears on that episode, and the sources are put into the show notes for each episode. We always want to give credit to the people that research the cases we talk about. Check out the store at tpublic.com/stores/brew-crime-podcast, where you can purchase gear like t-shirts, phone cases, stickers, pillows, and all kinds of other cool stuff. Brewcrime's intro was created by Mike using Creative Commons Attribution License audio from purple-planet.com, soundbible.com, and freesoundeffects.com. Logo design by Ben Greenberg. Thanks for listening to this podcast, and it's been a production of Pacific Beer Chat.
Hi there. My name's Elise, and I am a lawyer in the Pacific Northwest. I host this podcast, True Crime Cat Lawyer, with my co-host, Winston, my cat. She is a mustache, bow-tied, fierce little ball of sass, and we both come to you every other Thursday telling some stories from our hometown of the Pacific Northwest. We try to cover cases from Oregon, Washington, Alaska. We're hoping to cover some from Canada soon. And we just like telling crime stories that are lesser known in the true crime community, but we do also cover some of the big ones. And if you are interested in learning more about our podcast, True Crime Cat Lawyer, you can head over to our website, truecrimecatlawyer.com, or you can send us a quick email at truecrimecatlawyer@gmail.com. We're also on Instagram and Twitter, and we are available on pretty much every podcast platform that you will listen to. We hope you enjoy what you hear, and we hope you'll tune in. Thanks.
I don't want to forget to press record.
Please don't.
It would not be good. All right. Everything ready? You guys good?
Yep.
Oh, wait. I'll press the play on the intro.
And I'm Mamily.
Oh, sorry. I screwed up there. Oh, my God. No. That was my fault 100%.
And I'm so happy you're recording this. It's not live.
Imagine if it was live.
I just joked about fucking it up, and I fucked it up. I'll just start again.
Start again.
Take two. Today's theme is, let me just look up exactly how we worded it again, and then I'll edit this part out.
That's quite an understatement more.
Yeah.
I cannot speak, sorry.
No worries. Excuse me. Beer's back. And some cub contract. Pair of beer.
Sorry, I'm having a drink.
No worries.
And John, Booby D. I'm going to have to Google this 1 second. I don't know how to pronounce this. I'm scared I'm going to pronounce it wrong one.
No worries.
Why would you pronounce B-O-U-B-E-D-E?
Oh, I don't know. Bobity? Boobity? I don't know.
Bobity? I don't know. Just call him B. That's his name now. B.
Pronounce. Oh my God, it's not coming up.
Oh no. Put it through Google Translate.
I'm going to say boobied.
Okay.